What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to AJ Swoboda. Now, if AJ's name seems familiar, that's because AJ is actually the first person in Theology of Hustle history to be on this show twice. I mean, pretty big deal. It's a huge deal, really. But AJ came on a little bit over a year ago to talk about his book called Subversive Sabbath. I highly recommend going back and listen to that episode. It's super cool. But AJ came on to talk about his new book, which was recently released, called After Doubt, How to Question Your Faith Without Losing It. And I was so excited to have AJ on to talk about this book because I think it's really important. I think all of us at some point must go through some sort of deconstruction of our faith, of the things that we were taught when we were younger. And I'm seeing a lot of that in those around me, and frankly, in myself, at times throughout my life, sort of deconstructing and reconstructing and trying to draw closer to Jesus in that entire process. And just AJ is just making the case that we can deconstruct in ways that just draw us deeper into Jesus and into, in a culture where we want to be divided into sort of the left and the right and the extremes of those things. I think drawing nearer to Jesus is a corrective to that culture that seeks to divide us, frankly. And so there's so much good stuff in this episode. I can't wait for you to hear it. And I can't wait for you to check out the book, especially if you or someone you love is going through this process. It is such a helpful guide to these sorts of things. Before we get to the interview, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with all the great stuff we got going on the podcast. So I hope you really enjoy hearing from AJ. All right, AJ, thanks again for coming on the podcast, man. It's good to see you again. It's good to catch up a little bit.
It's a joy to be with you, Mr. Curry Blanford. It's a joy to be with you and to be with your awesome audience once again.
I love it. So we didn't talk about this before we got started, but I don't know that you know that you are the first person who's ever come on this podcast twice.
No, this is the level of pressure I'm facing right now. It changes everything.
That's a big deal.
Big deal.
Yeah.
And our last conversation on Sabbath, I forgot to tell you this too. We actually sing your song as a family now that you talked about.
The Shabbat Shalom?
We do.
What? We do. Well, to be clear, it's not my song, but sure, I just retweeted it and you just are, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So it's part of our family culture. My 4-year-old loves it.
Oh my
Shabbat
gosh.
Shabbat Shalom to, what's your son's name?
Britton.
Shabbat Shalom to Britton. Love it.
Yeah. So we light our candles. We sing the Shabbat Shalom.
So fun, man. That's terrific to hear.
Yeah. Sweet. Okay. Let's just do the quick intro to sort of like what you're doing now. All of that bio stuff.
Yeah. Well, I live in, so I live in Eugene, Oregon, where I am the assistant professor of Bible and theology at Bushnell University, which is one of the oldest universities in Oregon. Actually, it's a Christian liberal arts school here in Eugene. Great school. I teach here. I lead a doctor of ministry program at Fuller Seminary on the Holy Spirit and leadership. And I actually get to serve in my denomination. I'm the chair of our doctrine committee. So I get to help kind of form and shape some of our denomination's theological perspectives, which is really fun. So yeah, I'm a theologian. My wife, Quinn, my son, Elliot, our 12 chickens. We live here in Eugene on an inner city commune with an urban farm and love Jesus with all of our hearts.
Dude, that's a dream, man. You're living it. That's sweet.
I'm living a version of a dream. Indeed.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Sweet. Okay. So we're on, you're on today to talk about your book, which is, and it actually comes out.
Yesterday, March 2nd, you're talking to the author the day after his most emotionally anxious day he's ever walked through ever.
I had no idea. I did not prepare to enter into that emotional.
Yeah, I should be on a Zoom call with my counselor right now, but I've decided to be with you instead.
We'll talk some of that through. I mean, I can't fill that role completely, but we'll talk about some emotions and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm working on that as a fellow Enneagram 3. I'm sure you understand, like, getting in touch with your emotions can be a process.
Yeah, it's work. It's work.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So can you talk, maybe just give us the intro, maybe the rundown of the book a little bit.
I'd love to. Yeah. So After Doubt, subtitle is a pretty important part of that. How to question your faith without losing it. And the kind of big picture, the elevator pitch here, is that we have arrived at a point in Christian history, in particular in the West, where we have yet to fully grasp how to follow Jesus through this experience that we call the deconstruction experience. Mm. And this is, I'm going to guess, a very anybody listening to this knows what we're talking about here, and that is individuals who at some point received the Christian faith, they received the gospel, they believed, and at some point begin to really question those beliefs and question those ideas. And ultimately, we see this played out over Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, where all of a sudden we see our friends, our congregants, our family members begin to acknowledge publicly, I don't know if I'm a Christian anymore. Hmm. And this book, you know, big picture, is we have not adequately served God's people with a vision for how Christ meets us in doubt and deconstruction. Mm-hmm. The argument of this book is that God, if God can save us from our sin, he can certainly save us in our doubt. Mm-hmm. And that God can meet us right in the middle of it.
Yeah, that's good, AJ. I really loved the book. I think it's very timely and also just a resource that I have not found out there, because I think most every Christian goes through a deconstruction phase, right? I don't think there are always great resources to guide us through that. And a lot of the ones that I've run across, I don't know how to say this.
Can I name it? I'll name it for you. I'll fill in the blank here. In my experience of writing this book, here's what I've found, is that most people have some books on their shelf that essentially are of a more conservative ilk that say, doubt and deconstruction are inherently bad and ultimately lead to an abandoned faith. Or they have a whole set of books on their shelf that valorize doubt and deconstruction and seem to suggest that doubt and deconstruction are the only way to God. So one demonizes and one valorizes. And the problem is that essentially just creates pathways down these two roads that ultimately create more problems, because if we demonize doubt, then we're not inviting people to follow Jesus with their whole self. Yeah. But if we demonize it, or if we valorize it, then we are creating a new pathway to salvation where we say deconstruction is the only way to God. It's a new form of Gnosticism. You know, it's this new form of, so at the end of the day, this is not about going to the right or to the left. This is about going deeper into Jesus and finding God in the midst of it. And that I can tell is going to be one of the major critiques people have for this book, is that it is assumed that we're just trying to get progressives to become conservative. And that is not the point of this book. The point of this book is not to go from progressive to conservative, nor is it to go from conservative to progressive. It is actually to go deeper into Jesus wherever we find ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's great. And you did hit the nail on the head for what I was trying to articulate. But even like couching all this stuff in terms of conservative or progressive, like, just denies the true fact of what's actually going on. Like, we have this either or sort of mentality, and like, everybody wants to be sort of categorized.
Yeah.
Which is not the point of this whole thing, right? It's Jesus.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. In the book, I actually outline, and this is what I think is unique about the book, not arguing for sort of the middle way or the via media, sort of this, and I'm not saying moderate politically, I'm saying like that there's a third way. I think that's a good way to describe this. Is I outline 8 distinct practices that a person walking through doubt and deconstruction can begin to actually implement into their life. Like, what do I actually do when I start really questioning my faith? And so I outline 8 ancient practices that really have been key. And one of those practices is, at the end of the book, is this idea of embracing the whole kingdom. Mm-hmm. And here's why this is such an important practice. So many young people are deconstructing their conservative faith that they were handed, because they believe or see that their form of Christianity has upheld or been complicit in a whole variety of political things that they just can't stand by. And what that reveals is that the church has failed to capture the kingdom of God and has actually gone down this sort of partisan road. And the problem is, as a Christian, I face this all the time. Who do I vote for? You name one political party where I am simultaneously allowed to say that unborn children are made by God and should be cared for as the least of these, and that children in cages at the border matter to God equally as those unborn children. I don't have a political party to be able to say both of those things. And so that actually requires me to become an enemy of both parties in order to be a part of the kingdom of God. And ultimately, I think as long as the church kowtows to one political entity, we are going to bifurcate the kingdom of God and forget the whole thing. So we actually have to, it actually requires, and my friend John Tyson in New York wrote a whole thing on this. You know that you're preaching the good news of Jesus when both sides of the political spectrum are angry at you. And that is the sign, I think, that we're actually beginning to embrace the whole kingdom.
Yeah, I think you're right. I just had a whole thing happen with all of this sort of going down. We watched the PBS series on the Black Church as a church group, and we went through it and just talking a lot about these politics and this political divide. And I think even this idea that the church can't be political is just not true. I mean, the politics is the way we bring about good in the world, but I think there needs to be a distinction between political and partisan.
That's right? Exactly right. In fact, it's like you read the book last night. That's exactly what we're trying to get at here. You can't say, as a Christian, you can't say the phrase "Jesus is Lord" and say you're not political, right? Because you say Jesus is Lord, you are inherently saying President Joe Biden is not Lord. You are saying President Donald Trump is not Lord. You are saying my partisan party is not Lord. It is right. To be a Christian is a political act. The problem is when we make the church a partisan entity, and those are two fundamentally different things. We are political. We are called to subvert the system we find ourselves in. But the way that we do that is we don't do it by equating the church to a political party. We are called to follow Jesus. And that ultimately will get us in trouble with both sides. And it should.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus was hated. It's amazing. Jesus, there's a prophecy in Isaiah that the Spirit anointed one would come and lions would lie down with lambs. Children would put their, not be bit by snakes. You'd have all these predators that all of a sudden are friends. And when you look at Jesus, the Pharisees and Sadducees at the time, in the first century, actually hated each other. They were virulently against each other. They were, really arguing over, right interpretations, law, whatnot. And then Jesus comes along and they all of a sudden have a common cause. And what's interesting is that even Jesus knows how to bring his enemies together for a common cause. And I think my point here is that I do not believe there's any way for our sort of silent civil war that we are in right now to be healed outside of the reconciliatory work of Christ, of being the one that we do follow. That is non-negotiable. So for those in deconstruction and doubt, a lot of the times I find my students are struggling to believe because of the partisan issues that we're talking about. How do I deal with the fact that the church I was raised in propped up this whole system, this whole idea? How do I believe now?
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's what I loved about, I did really enjoy that there was some vulnerability from you in the book, that like this journey was deeply personal. And not only in your counseling of students, but in your own life. Can you talk just a little bit about that sort of background a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the 10th, I think it's the 9th or 10th book I've written. I need to look it up. I'm not sure, but of all the books I've written, I'll put it this way. There's little question that this book is the one that has caused me sleepless nights, anxiety. My spiritual directors made a lot of money during the writing of this book. Because I recognize, for example, my book on the Sabbath, it's a very important book and we all need to practice, rest and all that, but people don't disagree about the Sabbath and not go to Thanksgiving together anymore. This conversation about doubt and deconstruction is literally families that are separating over deconstruction, literally families that are falling apart because of this stuff. So I think when I wrote this, I really recognize this has a very, this stuff is real. These are real people. And for the person who is wandering through these doubt and deconstruction experiences, that's a very vulnerable and sacred place to be at in your life. And the kinds of things that books like this outline are actually attempts at helping people stay in the faith. And so
yeah,
it's terrifying. You know, it's terrifying. These conversations are hard. I mean, I've got family members that are going to read this book that are in the middle of what we're talking about here. And that scares me, but I'm not in a fear, not in a scared way. If anybody's ever said to you, Curry, do you still get nervous when you preach? You should always say yes, because to hold up the Bible in front of a group of people is a terrifying venture, because we will be judged by what we say.
Yeah.
So it's a very emotional journey. And I should say it's very emotional because I share my own deconstruction experience. And I learned some very hard lessons in that time. And I came out the other side towards what we call reconstruction. Actually having a fairly, I deconstructed my deconstruction. And in the middle of that deconstruction season, I learned some really hard lessons that I think I would want to look back and say, you know, if you're going to go through this, I want you to know what it looks like and what happens when you... There can come a point that when you deconstruct your faith too far, it is no longer the faith. So, you know, these are sensitive things.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And something that, like you said, most everybody has experienced to some extent. You know, I was thinking back on my, I've had probably a couple of different seasons of this, but like Bible college, nearly rocked me, which is kind of crazy. Like, people don't understand how emotionally taxing like theological education can be. I got so caught up in my own greatness, you know, through Bible college that it like, I became a jerk. I was just kind of a jerk to everybody, you know, and in that process of sort of deconstructing like elements while I'm sort of learning theology at the same time, like it's a highly emotional experience, right?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I think for a lot of people that go through a deconstruction experience, it dovetails on some level or is adjacent to some experience like that, where you, for example, for me, it was seminary. Going to seminary was a really beautiful experience, but it also shook me at my core. I mean, I remember I met Jesus when I was 16. When my first church I ever went to was this very conservative evangelical church in my hometown, which I look back on, I'm so grateful to God for that church. Mm-hmm. They taught me how to love Jesus for the first time. They taught me how to read the Bible. They taught me how to share my faith. They taught me about the Trinity. I mean, they taught me the core basics. But when I go to seminary and was able to actually look back on that experience, I also realized that they also handed me a very low view of women. And a very, I would say, deficient and non-biblical vision for women. And I actually needed to undo some of those aspects while holding on to the faith that I was handed in that church. And that process of holding on to the gospel that you've received from a community and simultaneously being willing to look back and critically reflect on some of the things that you were handed that weren't good is a very difficult thing to walk through. Yeah. But it is also a part of growing up, and a part of having a mature faith is that we have the capacity, like we would in a counselor's office, to look back on our family of origin and to receive all the good that it gave to us and simultaneously be able to name, and my dad wasn't really present. And my parents, you know, to be able to name our family of origin things. To be a healthy person is to name that stuff. Mm-hmm. How it's any different for a theological journey is beyond me. That is a part of the theological journey.
It has to be,
because otherwise we are going to create, the only way to protect against doing that is to be a part of, you know, it's to be a part of an organization where you're not allowed to actually become the person God's called you to be. We have a word for that. It's called a cult. And where you protect against people doing this work of reflection and thinking through what following Jesus looks like in their world. So we have to do it. We have to do it. I remember in the book, I tell the story of a woman who was, I met, was in the middle of her deconstruction experience. She had been raised in the church, and she had no boundaries as a kid, there was no differentiation. She was her family. Her mom, she says her mom would just barge into a room whenever she wants. She would never knock. She would never knock. She would just barge in, never knock. And so when this young woman goes to college, she of course deconstructs her faith. And after college has a kid. She really needed God after that because you need God after you have kids. And she started reengaging her faith. And she was reading the book of Revelation, and she read that point in the book of Revelation where Jesus stands at the door and knocks. Mm. And for the first time in her life, she recognized that God's posture has never been coercive. He invites. And for people that were raised in environments where the faith was coerced on some level, no wonder they deconstruct. They were never invited in. They were forced in. Mm. And she recognized that this God is way more, has better boundaries than anybody else.
Yeah.
And she began to believe again. So all this to say, I think if we're raised in environments where we don't permit people to become the people that they are, then we're going to create that deconstruction experience.
Yeah, for sure. I did appreciate all of that. And at the same time, like when we go through a deconstruction period, sort of questioning all the things we were ever taught, like you said, questioning the church we were raised in, one of the first things that goes is all of those institutions that we feel like did those things, correct?
Yeah. So let me be very clear here. What this book is not, and what I'm arguing, is not an argument that we need to burn the whole thing down. Right. That you would not have to work hard to find a whole litany of a cottage industry of podcasts and books that would argue, let's just raise the thing to the ground. Right. I actually have a book on my shelf here. It was written a number of years ago by David Dark, who is actually, I really think he's a really creative and brilliant thinker. I mean, he's a brilliant guy. He wrote a book a number of years ago called The Sacred Art of Questioning Everything. And I read the book, and essentially his argument is there's importance in questioning things. There's importance in pushing back. What I didn't like about the book was this idea of the sacred art of questioning everything. Mm. There are some things not worthy of being questioned. Let me give you one. The love of Christ for sinners. That is not worthy of being questioned. Honestly, there are some beliefs and core beliefs that in Christianity, we don't question. The resurrection, the bodily resurrection of Jesus, right. We're not debating this. It's done. And honestly, when we look at historic Christianity, the minute we start saying, well, Jesus didn't really raise, he raised in our hearts, we are violating the faith that we have been handed and essentially creating a new religion. Now, I'm fine if people want to do that. Just don't call it Christianity. Mm-hmm. Because this is not our faith. We don't get to make it for ourselves. We receive it. That's why Paul says, receive the faith. He puts the definite pronoun, the faith. It's like, and so there are some things not worth questioning that we can't question. Let me give you another one. We are called in the Nicene Creed to believe in the church. And that is as important a belief as believing in the Trinity and the resurrection. I believe in the church.
Yeah.
And to be a Christian, we need to have all the honesty in the world about what's wrong with our institutions. Absolutely important and good. But the minute we start saying we don't need the church, we're done, we are creating a new form of Christianity that is no longer historic Christianity. And so I am all about naming sin. And for the person in this conversation who was traumatized by the church, who was wounded by the church, who is deeply, deeply harmed by the church at any level, it is very important that we name the ways we were wrong, but it is also important that we still seek to believe that God's people can be redeemed. So yes, we need to bring honesty to the fore, but the minute we undo the whole thing, it's a new religion.
Yeah. I think that's important. And yeah, with how many people, like, it's easy to walk away from the church, to be honest with you, right? You talk about your college students and it's like, you just kind of don't show up, right? I mean, there's not like a lot to leaving the church.
Absolutely. Oh, I mean, it's easy to leave your marriage. I mean, I often tell when I'm in premarital counseling with a group, with people who are about to get married, one of my favorite sessions is to walk them through how many times a week I want my marriage to be over. You know, the number of times a week where I'm like, this is, I'm done. This is just ridiculous. I'm saying that a little tongue in cheek here, but the point is anybody who's honest about their marriage, it's a normal occurrence where you're like, it would be way easier for me, to part ways here. But of course, that trajectory of abandoning what is important and good and beautiful for the sake of individualism and for the sake of just going my own way, it may look sexy. It is at the end the road to hell. C.S. Lewis's depiction of hell in The Great Divorce is so timely for us because his depiction of hell is actually as a suburb. And it is a suburb where everybody keeps moving further and further and further and further apart. And this idea of embracing our freedom over our commitment and fidelity to the people of God and the people we love, it looks sexy, but in the end leads to a suburb we call hell. And I would say, yes, the church is easy to leave. And you're going to have your Sunday mornings free and you can do brunch and have mimosas. And it is fun. And I say at the front end, it is enjoyable. But long term, it leads to an emptiness of soul that we were never created to embody.
Yeah, I mean, the chips are stacked against us, especially as Americans, right? Like Western culture is a liberal society, not left wing, but like, you know, liberalism, like you talk about in the book. I mean, can you just talk about this aspect of individualism that just kind of creeps into everything?
Yeah. Well, if there is a chapter in the book that's going to get me tarred and feathered, it will be chapter 3, which is the title of the chapter is The Problem with Freedom. Liberal, yeah. The word liberal comes from the word freedom. It's this idea of a free society where we are given permission by God's grace, frankly, to make our own decisions for ourselves, our own decisions about the kinds of people we're going to become and the kinds of society we're going to build. I'm deeply grateful for the liberal tradition in that sense. I'm deeply grateful for this tradition I'm grateful we don't live in North Korea, where belief in Jesus gets you put in into a concentration camp. So I'm grateful for that. And there are some major problems with this liberal sort of approach to life that we have. And one of them I outline in the book is that it really does harm to our understanding of what it means to worship a God who is God. So there's a story of a guy named John Guest who came to America, and he's a British evangelist who came to America to do a series of evangelistic crusade talks and whatnot. And he comes to America, and he goes into this old merchandise shop I think it was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, near where the Constitution was signed. And he goes into this store, and it's filled with all this colonial era merchandise, you know, like "Don't Tread on Me," taxation without representation, all these kind of classic early American anti-British sentiments. And he walks out of that shop, and he sort of has this epiphany that America was formed essentially as a rejection of the sovereign. We rejected this idea of a sovereign king who was far off, who told us what to do. And he goes on to reflect on this. He says, you know, it's really hard. This is why preaching in America is so hard. How do you preach the sovereignty of God to a people that whose history is wrapped up in the rejection of the sovereign king? And he has this line. It actually is William Hooper, who was a friend of C.S. Lewis, has a line in his introduction to one of Lewis's books. And he says, He says, the idea of living in a free society has too quickly come to the place where we actually think we are free to create God who we want God to be. And his point is, this idea of the rejection of the sovereign has actually led to this posture where we create God in our own image. We can make God who we want him to be. Now, we have a word for that in the Bible. It's called idolatry. And the idea of idolatry is that we don't actually love God for who God is. We love God for who we want God to be. And so I would say one of the major downsides of a liberal, individualistic, expressive individualistic society like our own is that we've taken our freedom too far. And we have now begun to create a God that we want God to be. And that's a very dangerous posture. And the minute we start doing that, in the Bible, God doesn't, I mean, we have a commandment. Don't make God, don't form images of God. And that I think is a hard thing to hear because we are in a free society. But the minute we start freely creating the God that we want, we've kind of crossed a line.
Yeah. And we do this on both, like
on both sides.
We talk about sides, right? Yeah.
But so you talk about the conservative side. The minute we start equating, the minute we start assuming that white Western culture is sort of the normative Christian tradition, we are doing just this very thing. We are essentially embodying what we call ethnocentrism, this idea that one people group sort of has it and the rest don't have it. And that is one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is on the progressive side, this understanding that the Bible is useful to the degree that it talks about justice and hope and resurrection. But when it comes to its vision of sexuality, it is clearly stuck in the first century. Mm-hmm. And I had a young woman actually sitting in my office here who was saying to me, you know, when it comes to sexuality, I'm actually very conservative and on a lot of social issues, quite progressive, which puts me in a very funky place, as it does for all of us. But on the sexuality conversation, for example, we're sitting and talking and she's very progressive. And I said to her, she's a Christian. I say, you know, what do you think God thinks about this? And she says, well, I think God has evolved. And I said, well, what has God evolved to? And she said, well, I think God in the Bible kind of sort of was closed-minded. But now God has sort of opened up and is okay with what's happening. And I looked at her and I sort of blurted out. I didn't even realize what I was saying. And I said, wait a second. Are we talking about God or you? And I didn't even recognize when the words came out that there was actually a twinge of critique in that, because what she was saying was not that God has evolved. She was saying she's evolved and she needed God to be where she was. Mm-hmm. And that is the flip side of white nationalism on the conservative side. It is taking God and only loving him as long as he reflects us. And that is a very dangerous posture to have towards the living God.
Yeah, you're right. I think we just, like, this is the water we swim in. Like, we don't even know what's happening to us.
Yeah. 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 Here's the good news. Okay. Here's the good news. I want Jesus. I think you do too. And here's the good news. I think the majority of people that are deconstructing right now, actually at the end of the day, really want Jesus. And they're fed up with fake religion. And not all. I'm not baptizing the whole thing and saying it's all good. I'm saying that a lot of people, young people in particular, are deconstructing their faith because they actually really love God. Mm. And, you know, my wife and I, this is an illustration I've used often, but it really actually helps me to think about this. My wife and I grow our own tomatoes. We live in Oregon, and Oregon tomatoes in the summer, man. If you've never had them, I mean, you cannot eat these and tell me there's no God. They're so good, right? They're just so good.
Yeah.
And when we grow tomatoes, we will often have a couple over for dinner or something, and they'll come over. And there's usually somebody who doesn't like tomatoes, and I'll serve our tomatoes. And they'll say, well, I don't like tomatoes. And I'll say, well, you haven't had tomatoes yet. And they'll try our tomatoes. And then afterwards, they're like, these are tomatoes? And I'm like, yeah, these are tomatoes. And they're like, oh my gosh, I love tomatoes. And what you learn is that people don't hate tomatoes. People hate fake tomatoes.
Yeah.
They just haven't tasted the real thing yet. And I think a lot of people are deconstructing because they've been tasting fake Christianity for too long, and they actually are really hungry for God. And what I need to do as a leader is not assume that everybody in my life who's doubting or deconstructing is running from God. I need to assume that maybe they're actually looking for God. Mm. And there's good news in this, because this gives me a new opportunity to be a pastor. Let's talk about your struggles. Let's talk about that harm that was done to you when you were a kid in church. Let's get into that. And let's begin to repair and come back to your first love. Because the truth is, you probably do love Jesus. You just need some help to be able to understand how to walk through these struggles faithfully to him. You know, the parable of the prodigal son to me has just, it is, if you've never read the Gospels and you've never read some of these parables, I mean, they, to this day, are taught, they should be taught in every major university literary department, because they are just so freaking brilliant. The parable of the prodigal son, the younger son runs away and he takes his inheritance. He runs off, he parties, and then he wakes up and he comes home. There's an older brother. And I've always wondered, why did the younger son run away from the father? Why? And I had a student say to me, I don't think he ran away because of the father. I think he ran away because of the older brother. Hmm. And that more often than not, people are not deconstructing because of Christ. They're deconstructing because of Christians. And how sad it would be that we would allow the stupidity of some people of faith to keep us from the love of the Father. So at the end of the day, I actually think there's good news in this. I think the Father is calling a lot of people home. And the hard part is having to live in the same house with the older Christian again. It's hard.
Yeah, I appreciate that, AJ. That is such a hope-filled perspective change to kind of what's going on. I think even in my, and that resonates for like how I've experienced deconstruction in my life. You know, it was fed up with the things that I see around me, not with the God that I see in scripture. And frankly, a lot of that, a lot of the questioning even of God is an ignorance of how scripture should be properly sort of utilized, and the continuation from the Old Testament into the new, like a biblical theology of who God really is, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm with you, friend. I don't think the problem is the Bible. I think the problem is that we're sinners who don't know how to read the Bible.
Yeah.
I think the Bible is incredible. It is true. It's trustworthy. We're just really bad readers of the Bible. You know, Kurt, at the end of the day, to be able to talk about these things is very sacred and important. But my hope is that this book, this resource, becomes kind of an invitation to the young one in famine who wants to come back to the Father. There is a way, and you do not need to lean on your own wisdom to try to make it. There is an ancient tradition of 2,000 years of Christians who have struggled with their faith and have followed Jesus in the middle of it. And the truth is, all of us think that we have these unique, novel, new questions that somehow Christians haven't wrestled with. We've got 2,000 years of mothers and fathers who have wrestled with these questions and have been faithful to God in the middle of it. And there is a way to follow God in the middle of doubt. And that's my hope and dream, is that we have a generation of people that learn that doubt is not the end of faith.
Mm. Amen. What a hope-filled, Christ-exalting way of sort of looking at this whole thing. So I appreciate that. Thanks for the work, man. Thanks for the book. And I think it's going to be a great resource to a lot of people.
So I hope so. And thanks for your work as well, doing the work that you do to serve the people that you do.
Appreciate it, man. Well, thanks again, AJ. First one to be on twice. I mean, you like, that should be resume worthy. I'm just saying. So, you know,
made it on my CV. It's in my resume. I'm now going to get a job at Wheaton. Clearly I'm in, made it.
Hey, you know,
survive.
I got some connections, you know,
come
just
on,
let
baby.
You know.
Come on.
All right, man. Well, have a good rest of the day. Enjoy some molding of young minds.
Thanks a lot, friend.
Like I said, this is just such an important topic. I hope you got a lot out of this interview. This book has so much to offer, so I highly recommend you go pick it up. I've got all the links in the show notes there for you just to make it easy. And I just hope that if you're going through your own process, that you seek out materials like this just to help you seek out community, people who can really build you up. I think that's an important part of this process, and it has been for my own process. The community around me has been vital to making me who I am and drawing me closer into a deeper relationship with Jesus. So I hope you got a ton out of it. Hope you get a chance to check it out. This is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app, and you can leave a rating and review for me there just to make sure people know people are listening to A Theology of Hustle. It's just helpful to get the word out about the podcast. I appreciate you doing that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.